And we have before us today one of the most foundational chapters of the whole Bible. I'll make a bold claim. If we understand this chapter and we really get what it means, it will shape and change our view of the whole world, and it will shape and change our view of ourselves. And one of the things we're going to see today is the explanation for a tension in our world, which I'm sure you'll have experienced. Have you ever had that sense that life is sometimes very close to being actually really quite good? Perhaps you've had a sunny weekend, a lovely time with family and friends, and you've had a good day at church, and you think, do you know, life actually can be really fantastic. And then you have a silly argument with your wife, or your kids do something really stupid, or your boss sends you an incredibly annoying email on Monday morning, and it just seems that all the goodness of the world just evaporates. All the benefit you got from that nice weekend disappears in an instant. Or take a larger scale example. We look round at our world and we see great beauty, the beauty of nature, the kindness of men and women, the scientific and technological breakthroughs that make our lives easier. But then we turn the page of the newspaper and we see devastation and war, corruption, the abuse of power. A thousand stories of people dying too soon, potential not realised, innocence snatched away. On a day like today, we're remembering great things, aren't we? Remembering bravery and courage and sacrifice and goodness. But we're also remembering devastation and horror and war. And it seems as though life could be so good, life could be so enjoyable if only... And the list of if onlys extends and extends. And depending on your outlook, you can either end up a very, very frustrated optimist or a pessimist who can't quite give themselves to complete despair. What explains that tension? What explains that sense of frustration that life is simultaneously beautiful and awful, that we seem to be both blessed and cursed? Well, that's what we're going to see today in Genesis 5 and 6. And we're going to start with that wonderfully read genealogy in Genesis 5. I hope I get a prize for knowing the number, by the way. Well, we'll see, first point, life in the midst of death. Because in chapters 3 and 4 of Genesis, we've seen the state of humanity go from bad to worse. Cain, the boy that seemed like he might be the great hope of humanity, the boy that looked like he would be the serpent crusher promised in 3 verse 15, turns out to be a monster. He kills his own brother. And his line, his genealogy, is full of people who turn away from God and reject his creation design. Cain names a city after his son Enoch. He promotes the name of mankind over against the name of God. Lamech marries two women, rejecting God's design for marriage. And then Lamech boasts about his murderous, vengeful spirit. A young man hurts him, so Lamech kills him. And so the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5 comes as something of a relief. Let's look at chapter 4 verse 25. I'll start there. Adam made love to his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth, saying, God has granted me another child in place of Abel since Cain killed him. Seth also had a son, and he named him Enosh. At that time, people began to call on the name of the Lord's. This is the written account of Adam's family line. When God created mankind, he made them in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them, and he named them mankind when they were created. This at last looks like some good news, doesn't it? A third child is born to Adam and Eve, the boy Seth. They give thanks to God for his birth, and now people begin calling on the name of the Lord again. And this family line, unlike the line of Cain, is a family which have returned to true worship. And to mark this new family line, chapter 5 begins with that restatement of the creation design and purposes of God. We hear again what God was doing in his world when he created mankind. That man and woman would bear the likeness of God, and as male and female they would produce children who would flood the world with the likeness of God, who would declare that this earth belongs to him. And God named his people. That symbol of his sovereign rule over them, but also of his loving relationship with them. And so after all the horror of chapters 3 and 4, here is a reminder of what life ought to be. A life of blessing and joy and relationship with the God who made us. And the very next verse seems to continue that theme. Verse 3. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image. And he named him Seth. God made mankind in his own likeness, and now here is mankind producing children in the likeness of man, which is to say the likeness of God. Here is the creation design working as intended. Here, in the birth of a child, is a little sign that God has not yet given up on his world. It's a reminder of the great promise of chapter 3, verse 15, that there will one day be a child born in the line of Eve who will crush the serpent's head. And so here is the hope of life. But the hopes that are raised in these verses are quickly dashed by what comes next. Read verse 4 with me. After Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Adam lived 930 years and then he died. When Seth had lived 105 years, he became the father of Enosh. And after he became the father of Enosh, Seth lived 807 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Seth lived 912 years and then he died. And keep reading, as you heard it read, keep reading down that genealogy. You hear it, don't you? And then he died. And then he died. And then he died. The genealogy in chapter 4 didn't say that. It didn't include the information, and then he died. Presumably, everyone in the line of Cain did die. But here, the author makes a fact of death explicit and unavoidable. He puts it right in our faces. And then he died. And this one too, he died. And do you know what? He died. Why does he do that? Well, I think what we're seeing there is that tension. That tension that we see in our world and the tension that runs through the whole Bible. A tension between two promises of God's. God has made two promises. We've seen one already, that there will be one born in the line of Eve, the mother of all the living, who will crush the serpent's head, who will remove the enmity which exists between God and man, who will restore the creation to what it should be. A promise of blessing. But God's also made another promise. The promise in chapter 3 that Adam and all his race would die and their bodies would return to the dust because of their sin and rebellion. The promise of curse. Now God has made both of those promises. He must be faithful to them. He cannot deny himself. Mankind must face the punishment for their sin. God cannot sweep that under the carpet and pretend it hasn't happened, or else he would be unjust and corrupt. But God will not give up on his creation purposes either. He cannot let the serpent win by allowing sin to completely dominate and undo the world he's made. And so there is this tension, this unease, this frustration. On the one hand, the world is good. It thrums with life. Relationships flourish. Children are born. Progress is made. On the other hand, sin and sadness and suffering, and above all, the inescapable, brutal reality of death, seems to thwart all our efforts to remake this broken world. And so how will the tension be resolved? How can God be faithful to both these promises of blessing and curse? At this point in the story, we don't know yet. But at the midpoint of this genealogy, at the seventh in line from Seth, something very strange happens. The pattern breaks. Look at verse 21. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. And after he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enoch lived 365 years. Enoch walked with God, then he was no more, because God took him away. All of a sudden, in the midst of this cavalcade of death, a man doesn't die. God simply takes him away before his death. Now you'll notice there is a difference in the way Enoch is described in these verses. He is twice said to walk with God. But it would be a mistake to assume that that meant that Enoch was some super spiritual, super godly, holy figure. In the New Testament, in Hebrews chapter 11, that puts Enoch in the same bracket as Abel and Noah and Abraham and David, people who did die and were buried, as one of the heirs of the righteousness that is by faith. It's because Enoch trusts the promises of God that he walks with him and is qualified to enter God's presence, but he's no more godly or qualified than anyone else who trusts the promises of God. So why does God choose to do this? Why does he choose to just extract Enoch from the earth before his death? Well, I think it's to show that in this roiling battle between death and life, in this unbearable tension between blessing and curse, we know which one is going to win. God's purposes for his creation, his design for mankind to bear his likeness and bear his blessing and enjoy relationship with him, that will ultimately overcome the curse of judgment and death. Enoch's non-death proves the righteousness and the rightness and the reasonableness of trusting the promises of God. God has the power over death, and Enoch shows that God has the plan and the determination to overcome the curse of death with the promise of life. And that's what we see in the next little section, as we see hope in the midst of curse. Read with me from verse 25. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, he became the father of Lamech. And after he became the father of Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Methuselah lived 969 years and then he died. When Lamech had lived 882 years, he had a son. He named him Noah and said, "He will comfort us in the labour and painful toil of our hands caused by the ground the Lord has cursed." In Genesis 4, we saw the line of Cain paused at a man called Lamech, and we heard him speak words of vengeance, pride, and hatred. He lived his life with absolutely no reference to the God who made him. He was utterly convinced that he was in charge of his world, and that he had the power to bring curse and judgment on others for their treatment of him. That Lamech was a man in the likeness of the serpent, usurping God's position and God's status and claiming it for himself. Well, here is Lamech, now I think this is right, ninth cousin three times removed, who's also called Lamech. Funny how names run like that, isn't it? And the narrator pauses here to let us hear him speak. And his words could not be more different than his relatives. Once again, we see him name his son, that echo of God's naming of mankind back in the garden. And as so often in the Bible, his name's very significant. For a couple of reasons, actually. The word Noah actually means rest in Hebrew. And that takes us back to the seventh day of creation. The day when God rested from his work. The day he, if you like, sat down and then sat back to survey a job well done. And that day he issued an invitation to the world to enjoy his rest with him. He blessed that day and said, "Come and enjoy it. Come and enjoy peace with me. Come and enjoy the world that I have made." Well, as you know, we rejected that offer. And the result that we see in Genesis 3 and 4 is the curse of restlessness. Restlessness in terms of toil. Work would be hard and relentless. Do you know that sense you get when you finish a job, or you start a job, and you have everything you need, and nothing major goes wrong, and you finish in good time, and you don't overspend, and you're satisfied with your work, and everyone else is pleased? Do you know that? Do you? I mean, it happens very, very occasionally, doesn't it? It happens very, very, very rarely. A brief glimpse of what work could be, and you think, why can't it be like this every time? And so often what people do, you may have noticed this, is that people change jobs and change careers and move towns and try new time management or try new productivity techniques to try and keep hold of that sense of satisfaction, that sense of rest, but it never really works. And so you've got to, by the way, if you want a burgeoning, flourishing career, productivity, you know, invent a new productivity tool. People will buy that, lap that stuff up because work is hard and it never works. So you keep making new stuff. Then you make a lot of money. Don't do that, obviously. The point is, it never works. It's never reliable. It never lasts long. Because work is hard and frustrating and unstable, and so we are restless in our work. But there's also that sense of restlessness in terms of homelessness. Remember Cain, cursed to a restless existence, wandering the earth without anywhere to call a home, without any place where he belonged, without any place where he fit. And you see that in our world too, don't you? You can see in our world today people continuing to struggle to find a place where they belong, a place where they can be themselves, where they're safe. We don't seem to fit. That makes us anxious. And that too is something that's been lost in our rebellion against the Lord. Because it's with him. It's in relationship with the God who made us and knows what's best for us. That's where we belong. And so because we are homeless away from our Lord, we're restless. And so we're restless in terms of work and restless in terms of homelessness. And Lamech says, "Well, here's my son. I'm going to call him Rest." But not only that, Lamech says he will bring comfort. The word Noah means rest, but it sounds a lot like the Hebrew word for comfort or compassion, and that's the play on words that Lamech is bringing about here. He says that his son will comfort us in the labour and painful toil of our hands. Lamech prophesies that through Noah, God will have compassion on the world, that he'll bring relief from the curse that God has put on the planet because of a rebellion against him. I wonder what you make of Lamech's words. Could this be just the proud boasting of a new father over his firstborn son? You know, when you gaze into the tiny bundle of joy covered in mucus, and all you can see is potential. Is that what's going on here? Or is there something more? Well, as you'll know about, be exploring as you continue in Genesis, whatever you do, Noah does bring a kind of comfort, a kind of rest to God's world, but it's very clearly not the final finished rest that Lamech foresees. We do see God's compassion shown through Noah, but it's a compassion that manifests itself through severe judgment. And so once again, the fulfillment of Lamech's words is slightly put on hold, because that tension continues to exist. The tension between the hope of rest and the curse that just keeps going. And just as Enoch was not the end of the story, so neither will Noah be. But again, we see here the plans and purposes of God shine through in amongst the death and sin and suffering of his broken world. God looks on a restless world, cursed to toil, cursed to homelessness because of their rebellion against him. And he looks upon that world with compassion, with grace, with mercy, and with the desire to bring his rebellious creatures a homecoming, a safe and satisfying and sinless future. That is what God wants for our world. But once again, we have to leave that glimpse there, tantalizing us as we move on to the next section, which I've titled Grace in the Midst of Judgment. And once again, chapter 6 starts with a glimmer of hope. Look at verse 1. When men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them. Now, it's very easy to just skip past that to the interesting bit in verse 2. But we must pause there and not skip past verse 1. Men are beginning to increase in number on the earth and they're having children. This is good news. That is exactly the command that God gave to Adam and Eve back in chapter 1. That they should be fruitful and multiply and increase upon the earth. To spread his likeness over all his creation. To put his stamp, his signature on the artistry and beauty and glory of what he'd made. But although that looks like good news, once again, it won't stop this tension between God's creation purposes and the sin and curse of mankind. It just keeps going. Let's read from verse 1 again. When men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he's mortal. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the hearers of old, men of renown." Now, we've got to have a little pause there, haven't we, and work out a little bit of work figuring out what this means. As I'm sure you realise, the big question that we've got to answer here is, who are these sons of God, and who are these Nephilim, and basically what on earth is going on? Well, I hope you don't mind if I take a little step back and tell you about three different ways these verses have been read over the years. I should say that all of these approaches have been taken by people who are much cleverer and much more godly than me. So although I am going to come down on one of them, do take some time to think about these yourself and ask Richard, who is both much cleverer and more godly than I am, so he'll have a better answer. The first approach, which has been taken by lots of people, is that this is describing angelic beings, called the sons of God here, sleeping with human women and producing a sort of superhuman race, the Nephilim. Very tall and strong. Again, a bit like Richard. Support for this idea might come from places like Jude, verses 6 and 7, which make a link between the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah and the sins of angelic beings. And also in Job 1, the angels are called sons of God. So that's possible. I have a bit of difficulty with that one. I have difficulty with that because Jesus seems to strongly imply in Matthew that angels are not sexual beings. He says there that in the new creation we're not going to marry each other because we'll be like the angels in heaven. And as well as that, if it's possible for angels and humans to sort of crossbreed and produce a hybrid race, I think the logic of the gospel is in a bit of trouble. The book of Hebrews tells us that Jesus didn't become like the angels in order to save the angels. He took on flesh and blood to become like humans so he could save humans. It says explicitly, it was not angels he came to save, but the sons of Abraham. So if there is angelic blood coursing through any human's veins, I think that might put them outside of the reach of Christ's salvation, which is problematic. But the main reason I'm not so keen on that interpretation, again, lots of clever and godly people have thought this, so I'm probably wrong, but I'm not keen on it, because the flow of the Genesis narrative, the whole logic of this section, is about the progress of human sin, not angelic sin. That's the big thing we see going on. In verse 3, God responds to the sin of verse 2 by limiting the lifespan of humans. And in verse 5, he notes the depravity of the human heart. We'll come back to those verses. But you see, if verse 2 is talking about the sin of angels, I think it's a bit confusing as why God punishes mankind in response. So if that's not true, might be, but I don't think it is. What other options have we got? Well, another idea is that the sons of God refers to the line of Seth's descendants, that Genesis 5 line, and the daughters of humans to the line of Cain's descendants. So what we're seeing here is sort of intermarriage between God's people and people who worship idols. Now, that is going to be a huge issue later in the life of God's people, where romantic attraction and loyalty to another human being begins to take precedence over loyalty to God. But I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure there's enough warrant to call the line of Seth sons of God in this context. So, thank you for bearing with me on that. The interpretation that I reckon is right here is to notice that the phrase sons of God can refer in the Old Testament to rulers and kings. You can see this in the Psalms, where the king in the line of David is called God's son. And Psalm 82 refers to pagan kings as sons of the Most High. And the behaviour in verse 2 of these sons of God makes sense in that context. Verse 2 says that these sons of God married any woman they wanted. They took any woman they chose. In other words, I think this is human rulers, people with worldly power, using that power to dominate women. And perhaps particularly to bring multiple women into their sort of harems in order to make a name for themselves, to demonstrate their superiority. Now, we have already seen someone like this. We've seen Lamech in chapter 4, strong and powerful man marrying two women and seems to be rather dominant over them. We're going to see it again in Genesis 12 when the Pharaoh of Egypt feels perfectly at liberty to simply take Sarah as his wife without her consent. And we can understand, couldn't we, how powerful men and beautiful women might produce as their heirs strong and powerful men like the Nephilim. Men of renown. Literally, by the way, men of a name. Men who delight in making a name for themselves as their fathers did. And what attracts me to that interpretation is that it fits with the general downward spiral that we're seeing in these early chapters of Genesis. As every single facet, every single part of God's creation designed for his people is subverted and perverted and ruined. Here we see the joyful covenant union of marriage corrupted by the lust for power and the lust for sex into something rapacious and destructive and ugly. And so we see the sin of Adam and Eve magnified and extended and expanded. In fact, a literal translation of verse 2 runs like this. The sons of God saw that the daughters of men were good and they took them. Where have you heard that language before? It's exactly the language of Eve with the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. She saw that the fruit was good and so she took it. And it's also reminiscent of the language of God as he looks at his creation, but with a horrible difference. Do you remember God in Genesis 1 saw that what he'd made was good, and so he blessed it. And he gave it to others. And he named it truthfully, and he interpreted it for us. What does mankind do when mankind sees that something is good? We take it. And we grab it for ourselves. And we name it whatever we want it to be to make it okay for us to take. What we see here is mankind knowing good and evil, that is, deciding for themselves what is good for them, usurping God's right to tell us what is good for us, and taking and snatching and dominating and causing pain and havoc and destruction as a result. And so it is no wonder that God pronounces his verdict in verse 3. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they're mortal. Their days will be 120 years. God limits the lifespan of his creatures in order, I think, to limit the damage they can do. God's spirit, who is breathed into human beings to give them life, is now said to contend with humans. In other words, mankind is now constantly doing battle against God's wishes, against God's wisdom, against God's way of doing things. We are involved in a pitched battle against the Spirit who gives us life. And God decides that can't go on. That can't go on forever. Indeed, the rebellion simply cannot continue. Look at verse 5. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he'd made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I've created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I've made them. All this way through this passage, we've seen the knife-edge tension between the promise of God to bless his people and the promise of God to judge their rebellion against him. And here, it seems as though the judgment is going to carry the day. The sin of mankind has utterly taken root in their hearts. Every inclination of their thoughts of their heart is only evil all the time. Without the Lord choosing to limit our evil by cutting short our days, without his spirit contending with us to protect us from ourselves and prevent us from being as bad as we could be, without the Lord's grace, without that we would plunge headlong into out and out rebellion against him. That's where our hearts lead. That's where our hearts of everyone in the world leads. It's towards evil. And so bad has the situation become that God even says he regrets making us in the first place. That's extraordinary language, isn't it? When we read that language, we have to remember that God is God and we're not gods. That when the Lord is said to regret something, it's not exactly like the way we regret things. We regret our decisions because we've made a mistake. Well, God doesn't make mistakes. But here, the chaos and evil and destruction that mankind is wreaking on himself, on his creation, well, that is paining his heart. And so he begins a decreation project. In Genesis 1 and 2, God makes animals, birds, and creatures that move along the ground and crowns it all with the human race. And now in Genesis 6, God resolves to destroy the animals, the birds, the creatures that move along the ground, and the human race with it. This is the low point of man's relationship with God. This is our darkest hour. This looks like the end of God's creation purposes. It looks like the end of the world. And yet, as perhaps we've come to expect by now, the drama continues. The tension keeps going. Verse 8, but Noah found favour in the eyes of the Lord. You're going to go on to meet Noah in the next week or so. And although the narrative does set him apart from the rest of mankind, as we see Enoch set apart from the rest of mankind, we need to remember that Noah himself is a sinner and a rebel just like everyone else. That will become clear in due course. But right now, what do we see? We see a man finding favour in God's eyes. That is, a man who finds grace from the Lord. Out of nowhere... out of the very depths of human depravity and God's justice, suddenly out of nowhere a beacon of light is turned on. Out of nowhere we find a man who does not receive the judgment he deserves. Out of nowhere there is still a glimmer of hope for this sinful, cursed, judged creation. God has not given up. He will be faithful to his promises. And so there is grace in the midst of judgment. But as we conclude and draw the threads of this passage together, I wonder if the same question occurs to you as it does to me. The question this passage ought to raise in our minds is how? How will the tension get resolved? How can God possibly bring hope to his world? Because think of what we've seen. Here is a world populated by people who are dying under the curse of God. Here is a world who are restless and alienated, lost without relationship with God, suffering and toiling. Here is a world hell-bent on rebelling against God and twisting and distorting his creation purposes out of all recognition. Here is a world whose very existence grieves God to his heart. And so here is a world under the judgment of God, a hair's breadth away from being completely and deservedly wiped out. And yet here is a world where a man can, out of nowhere, just not die. Here is a world where the promises of God of salvation, of rest, of compassion are passed down and reiterated through generations and kept fresh. Here is a world where sinful men can be shown grace and favour. Here is a world where, as it seems to be dangling over the precipice of certain destruction, always gets pulled back by God's kindness just in the nick of time. How long can this go on? How long can this continue? And what is the solution? Well, one thing is clear from this passage. The solution must come. It must come solely and completely from God himself. It is very clear that mankind cannot save ourselves. Without the compassion and grace of God, there is no hope. And yet this passage is saturated with exactly that compassion and that grace. And one of the key indicators of that grace is a very subtle thing that's difficult to spot. In chapter 6, verse 6. Because there we read, "The Lord regretted that he'd made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled." It's tricky to spot for us reading this section in English translation, but the Hebrew words used in that verse are exactly the same as the words used by Lamech of his son Noah in 5 verse 29. Lamech says that they are undergoing painful toil. Literally, they are troubled by the world, by God's curse on the world. And in 6 verse 6, God says that his heart is troubled. Exactly the same words. Lamech says in 5:29 that Noah will comfort us, will show pity and compassion. And in 6 verse 6, God says that he regrets or is sorry. And surprisingly, that is also the same word. God's sorrow over his world comes from his compassion towards it. Why is that significant, that little hint? Well, this points us forward to the solution that will eventually come. Because we see God, in chapter 6, verse 6, described as entering into the pain of his own world. We see the hint that the troubles that mankind faces because the curse of God are in some senses experienced by God himself. He has caused us in his curse troubles, but his heart is also troubled. He's experiencing it himself. Now, at this point in salvation history, this is subtle and shadowy. These are hints and nothing more. But thousands of years later, that compassion of God for his world spilled over, came to its climax as Jesus Christ, God himself, entered into the world as a man fully able to sympathize with our curse. A man who had deep compassion and fellow sympathy with us, and crucially, a man who was troubled, a man who faced the trouble of the curse himself, a man who resolved this tension between curse and blessing. Because in Jesus Christ, the full weight of God's wrath and God's curse and the punishment we deserve was taken and satisfied. At the cross, the world ended. The sky turned black. God's judgment fell in its entirety without being limited by his grace on Christ. And that meant that his compassion, his mercy, the promises of blessing could flow from the risen Christ to all who put their trust in him, like Enoch, like Noah. The tension is resolved because in the cross of Christ we have complete justice and complete blessing. As Paul would put it later on in Galatians, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. He has done it. He has resolved the tension. He has borne the curse, fulfilling the promises of God to curse. And he's brought the blessing, fulfilling the promises of God to bless. So I wonder, as we finish, how you respond to that. It might be that you're not yet a believer, that you're investigating things for the first time, or you have been for a while, and that is fantastic. And I encourage you to keep investigating. But if that's you, can I leave you with this question? Does this description of the world ring true for you? Do you see this tension between goodness and pain? between blessing and curse. Do you see the restlessness of this world? Do you see the restlessness of your heart? Do you see in your own life the ability to do wonderful things and awful things? Well, here is as clear and coherent an explanation as you will ever find for why we are like this. But more than that, here is hope. Here is hope for forgiveness. Here is hope for rest. Here is hope for salvation, for a restored relationship with God that will start now and will last forever. It's found in Jesus Christ. And if you have yet to find that rest in Him, then keep looking, keep asking. Come and speak to the guys here and they will help you. And if you are already a believer in Jesus, I hope this passage encourages you. I hope it encourages you to keep trusting in Him in the midst of that tense and restless world in which we live. Don't be seduced by the goodness of this world to forget that it's a world under judgment. That's easy to do, isn't it? We can get so used to the goodness and the comfort of life that we sort of get a bit comfortable ourselves. Don't forget that this is a world wracked with pain and suffering that is forever a hair's breadth away from God's final judgment on it. Don't forget that. Keep that memory and that belief sharp. But also, don't despair at the sin and suffering of this world. Easy to do that too as well, isn't it? When we feel pain ourselves, when we see pain in our world, we can just think we're just going to give up. It's too hard. But don't despair. Because when God's final judgment does fall, be sure that Christ has taken your share of it for you. And as we enjoy the relationship with God that Christ has won for us now, be sure that we're not home yet. Look forward to the rest that God will finally bring about in His new creation, and look forward to it with confidence, because God has been faithful to His promises. He's been faithful to His promise to curse, and wonderfully, mercifully, He has been faithful to His promise to bless.